Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere Commerce Case Study Debugging Common Runtime Support Questions. Today's presenters are Eric Rybczynski and Jim Barnes. Eric joined the WebSphere Commerce Level 2 support team as a software engineer in December 2007. In this role, he handles various support concerns from customers. He has been in the software group since 2002 and in software support since 2006. Jim joined the WebSphere Commerce Level 2 support team as a software engineer in August 2011. In this role, he handles various support concerns from customers, specifically around performance, development, and marketing-related issues. He has been in the software group support organizations since 2003, working with WebSphere Portal prior to joining the WebSphere Commerce team. At this point in time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Eric and Jim.
All right, thank you, Joseph. If we can move to slide number one or slide number two. All right, so our agenda for today is we'll be reviewing several case studies, and we'll cover the area of the scheduler, and we have several issues in that area we'll go over. Some of those are like the can't find command and the connection timeouts. We'll also be reviewing the cross-site scripting protection and some of the errors we occur during those times, so things like invalid URL and redirecting to different host names and domains. Merchant keys, we will also look at some of the areas that happen during migrating encrypted info and how you can resolve those. And then we'll also be looking at mobile stores and how some of the redirection happens or doesn't happen, as the case may be, and how you can resolve those. Slide three, please. So first, starting off with the scheduler. One of the issues we've seen repeatedly, especially in development environments, is multiple environments with the same database are all talking to the same database instance in the back end. So the types of errors you'll see in this area, you'll see the command runs once and then starts failing. Or sometimes it'll intermittently work. And you also may see command only works when hit via the URL to the instance that the developer is testing against. The best way to troubleshoot this is to look at the scheduler must gather. And what this will cover is you will turn on server tracing as well as scheduler tracing, and you'll do some exports against the various tables. This could show a lot of information related to the scheduler. And what we're going to look at that is how you look through those files and see what the scheduler is actually doing. So we review the SCH config, and this shows us the configuration of the scheduler and the jobs that are going on. Then we will find the job reference number for the job, and we will take that's also equal to the instance reference number, you know, or find the job reference number on the SC status table using the reference number. This will show us the job that ran and its status. So one of the things to check on the SC status table is the state. If it's C, it equals complete. Anything else means it did not or is not complete. So it could be currently running, it could be partially failing, or it could be paused. You know, there's several states, but C is complete, and the other ones mean it didn't work correctly or is not running. Slide four. So after we collected the must-gather for this issue, reviewed this, we got the job reference number, and we see the you know, it wasn't complete, and so we're then going to take that reference number and look in the error log table for errors. This is many times it's a blob, so you might have to, you know, a simple extract might not get it, so you'll have to extract the whole string and look for this error and see what it is. So then we're going to take that message and look into the error logs, and then work back from there to see where the failure occurred. Slide five. Now, what a lot of times we see in multiple environments is that we don't don't see the error captured in the logs. And the reason being is that, you know, either the trace was too fast or the job did not run on the server instance. This is where a lot of times you end up scratching your head and wondering, well, I see that, you know, the timestamp in the error log table is covered by the time that the error, that the trace log's covered, but the error is not there. And, you know, taking, you know, this doesn't make sense on the surface, but then when you step back a minute, that means it ran somewhere else. You know, things don't just mystically not put files, you know, put the right entries in the trace log. So what we can look at is if we look at the SC sat left column, it'll actually tell us where it ran. And if you look at the traces for the scheduler get ready to run late jobs, it's actually going to look and tell you what host name it's using at the time when it's running. Most times it's going to be something like localhost and then a hexadecimal string. And then you can compare that to what the status job and see if they match. If they don't match, that tells you that the traces where you took the server is not the server where the job actually ran. And this can happen because all the servers talk to the database. They're going to talk to the database, and the first one running is going to pick it up and run with it. Now, the other, so you, all you're seeing is all these error logs whenever you look at it from, you know, you look at the jobs table, but you never see the actual errors in your traces. Slide 6. So, we see all these instances using the same database. So the easiest way, if you want to continue using the same database, is to edit the config for the command and populate the host field. That way you can set it to the server, the development server that actually has the information for the command and the stress config files. Because usually what happens, you know, if you have one developer that's testing on it, they're going to have updated their stress config files for the action, but the other ones won't. So this will fail when it's actually trying to look up the action command in the stress config files. So what you would then do is just make sure that you put in the host value for the server you wanted to test on, and that way only that server would try to run that job via the scheduler. Slide 7. Now, the other one we see a lot, and you'll see this in the error log for the multiple database as well, is can't find command. And so we can see command may fail with the following. Error command, command not found. This is pretty common, and so we gather the same scheduler must gather data, you know, the tracing in the database tables. When the command, what we're going to need to do is understand the order which they run. So when a command is trying to run, the code looks at several layers before it is finally run. So first off, it's going to look at the URL registry, which this is loaded on startup from the store's stress config files. There's also the URL registry that is part of the accelerator and the management center, but those are what are termed lazy loaded. So those are only loaded when you access the management center. So the only ones you get by default when the server starts is what's in the store stress config. So then we look in the SCC path and the scheduler config table, and that path is checked against the URL registry for the command interface. We then take the command interface against the command reg table and search for the implementation class. So depending on where it says it can't find it, it really helps to tell you what part of the config is missing. So if you see the command and it never took it from the URL to the command interface, then you see it's not, it didn't find the URL registry. If it found the interface but didn't find the implementation, it's missing the command reg. So that's how you can tell where you're missing based upon what it says command not found. Because it can actually, it can sometimes be the URL, like my custom command like you see here, or it could be the command interface, or it could be the implementation class. Slide 8. So as you see here, in this case, the URL cannot be converted into the command interface. In this case, the command is defined in the stress config for the management center and not for the stores. So the way you resolve this is that you then move the command, the action, into the stress config for your stores. And that way, those are loaded to start up, and the schedule will be able to follow those. Because what we're seeing in this case, the user would log into the management center, and then the scheduler would start working, because now it can find them, because those have been added to the URL registry. And that's how that, it was very odd, because, you know, you would see it fail, you would see people log in to the management center in the accelerator to check on it, to see, you know, what the status was, and then it would start working. So it was very odd, but that was how you can look at what the error message is telling you to see why they're failing. Slide 9. All right, so another case of this scheduler is you may see a connection timeout error. One of the things to be aware of is that in V7 and later, we need to be able to access the node agent if it's in a cluster environment. So usually you'll see this as no jobs are currently running on the affected server. Scheduler just, you're not even getting updates. It's not even running the scheduler service. You don't even see any errors going to error log. You'll see the status table being updated. And so this can be a little confusing to troubleshoot depending on how fast your logs have scrolled, because it's not going to be tracing anymore, so turning on tracing really doesn't do anything. We will try to collect MustGather for this issue as well. But we'll also look at the logs. So we're going to look to see if the SC status and error log tables are getting any entries. And in this case, they weren't. And looking back through the logs, we see that during startup, we couldn't actually get to the node agent. Now, if you actually look back at the actual system outs, we see that during startup, it couldn't even discover the node agent as well. So in this case, the node agent had failed and was sitting there hung and wasn't accepting any requests. Slide 9, or slide 10, I mean. So, the case here is just not accessible to the Commerce server. So the best way to resolve this is to fix your node agent and ensure it started with no errors. Then restart the node where you saw this message. Now, your store keeps serving stuff, but a lot of the things that the scheduler depends on won't work until you restart, and then it'll be able to connect to the node agent and continue forward. Slide 11. Now, another case where no job's running, as well as no update to the scheduler logs, we'll look at the MustGather again. So now we're going to look again, see if we see anything in the two tables, the status and the error log tables. And then here we don't see anything. So again, similar issue, but different problem. We're going to check the traces to see what is being logged. So here we see this application trying to initialize, but it fails. So Commerce failed to initialize during startup. Now the server seems all right, but we have to look back a little bit and see what the specific error is thrown. And we see here that Solar failed with a verify error at this stage during startup. Slide 12. So what had happened was the Solar config was corrupted. And this prevented the scheduler from starting up correctly, and it just sat there never initializing, even though the store looked to be up. The Solar really wasn't being used, but it had caused a corruption because some files had gotten messed up and they thought it was being used. So the scheduler never started. So what they just need to do is to fix the Solar configuration to be valid, and then you restart the node so the scheduler retries to initialize. All right, slide 13. And I'll now turn it over to Eric.
Thank you, Jim. So on slide 13, we'll start talking about the cross-site victim protection and some of the common issues that we've seen and how to investigate and handle those error conditions as well. The cross-site scripting protection, just to give a brief overview on what it does, is basically in the URL, there may be some malicious users that try to hack the URL to add in JavaScript. So when innocent users click on those links, they actually would be expecting to go to your storefront website, but end up executing some other action that's not what their primary intention was. So the cross-site scripting protection takes place to help prevent those redirects from occurring. So, for example, so you don't end up sending a redirect for a customer that goes to your storefront end up being redirected to your competitor's storefront. So back to the WSTE, the invalid URL condition, this is where you try to see a web page, but after you get redirected, you just see a blank page. Now, this is where the cross-site scripting protection would normally behave. It would say invalid characters observed in the URL. So if you want to double-check this condition and see if it's matching against what you are experiencing, you can open the system.out.log file and examine the error log, and you can see the error message saying that the value of the parameter URL is not correct. Now, move on to slide number 14, please. To gather some additional information about why it's throwing this error message, we would need to enable the WC_server trace. And with that trace, we can gather more information about why did it say that. So in this log sample, we see the is redirect allowed entry, and then we see the URL that we are going to redirect to. And then the following string, the following line, we see the host name being identified as server2.domain2.com. And from there, it says it doesn't match the addition rules and throws the exception. To look at this error condition a little bit further to make sure we understand how it works, we would need to look at the instance HTML file. And there are two areas to look at. The first is the URL redirect filter enablement. You can have the option to actually turn it off if you do not want the redirect protection. This may be more common for internal business tools users, such as accelerator, management tools, org admin console, and so forth. The recommended option would be to add either an allowed host entry where you specify the full host name, such as server2.domain2.com, or you add the domain, domain2.com, or both. Move on to slide number 15, please. As I just mentioned on the previous slide, the URL redirect filtering is strict on which domain it can redirect to. So if it's not in the instance HTML list, it won't allow the redirection to occur. And then it ends in that blank page here. After you make the change to the instance.html file to either add the host name or the domain entry, or both, to the HTML, or you can disable the redirect filter, you would need to then run the update year config ant job that would take the updated instance.html file and deploy it to the application server environment so that it deploys to the ear and then spreads out and deploys to the cluster members if you are in a cluster. Slide number 16, please. Another common scenario is that we see prohibited characters showing up. And in some cases, it's intentional that we want that to happen, and in some cases, it's not intentional for that to happen. So we'll look at this scenario where it is not intentional for it to happen. So for example, we go to this URL, the subscription view URL, and then we see the prohibited character error message, and then in the system out log file, we will see this logged in the system out file as well. Slide number 17, please. Now, to better understand why we see this happen, we would need to enable the WC server trace again. And when we enable the WCT arbitrage, we can re-enter the URL into the browser, click go, and then the phone line should be logged. And in this line, it gives us a wealth of information. It gives us the regular expression that matches again, and then it gives us the string portion that matches again. And we can see, oh, this is actually not what we wanted the cross-site protection to detect. So in this case, the regular expression is looking for anything with the word script in it. And in our URL, in our view, we have subscription view, and script is right in the middle of that. It's slide number 18, please. So, first of all, once you look at the URL, we want to make sure that it's appropriate, that we want it to go through normally as expected. Or if it's not something that we're expecting to go through, we want to make sure that the protection for that URL is still in place. Now, we can also determine to control the cross-site scripting protection on different modules, such as the storage module or the management center module or the admin console module. And if it doesn't need the cross-site protection, we can disable that by setting enable equals false. If we do determine that the URL needs to be allowed through, and we still determine that the cross-site scripting protection needs to be enabled, then we need to look at the instance XML. We'll go to slide number 19, please. And inside the instance XML, you can scroll down to the bottom where they have the rules defined for the cross-site scripting protection section. And inside that section, you will see different standards, such as prohibited characters and then character display. And in our particular example, we're focusing on the character display equals false, regex equals the regular expression filtering out all the words with script in it. In our case, the subscription view is a URL that we want to allow to get through. So we have to look at it and determine maybe we need to filter out only the ones that have the angle bracket before the script keyword. So in our example solution, we change it by adding the angle bracket before the word script, which is the ampersand LT semicolon. And you can also come up with your own regular expression as well. If we use the regular expression from Java, so if you go to the Java doc information about the regex expression, you can use any of those regular expressions to filter out all the good and the bad from your cross-site scripting protection keyword filtering. Slide number 20, please. Next, we'll talk a little bit about the emergency. I wanted to also take the time to promote another WSTE, which will be doing a much deeper dive on the emergency configuration and issues and scenarios, and that will be taking place on April 17th, and it will be given by my colleague, Mike Arrington. I highly recommend this WSTE, especially if you are concerned with PCI compliance and security. It's a wonderful wealth of information that will be available in that presentation, so I encourage you to all go listen to that. And in this presentation, we'll focus on the migrate encrypted info section, since that tends to be an area where we get a lot of questions on, so I just want to make sure that we address the common scenarios in this presentation in regard to the emergency, and then my colleague Mike will be presenting a much more in-depth overview of the emergency and troubleshooting those scenarios as well. when you run the merging to migrate encrypted info script, that's when you are trying to rotate your merging key just so that you stay in PCI compliant. Typically, it can be perhaps once a quarter, depending on the PCI rules that you need to comply by. In this scenario here, on slide number 20, we'll be looking at an error that's being thrown when the current merging key used to decrypt is not the same as the one that was used to encrypt the user's password originally. So, and we'll go into what the log output would appear on the next slide, but on this slide, I wanted to point out the basic notionality checkpoint. First, you want to run the wcs_encrypt.sh, followed by the merging key value that you're trying to, the current merging key that you'll be rotating out. And once that command runs, it will give you a hex string and a ASCII string. Both are encrypted. And you want to compare the ASCII encrypted value to make sure it matches that inside the instance XML. Or if you are using a key locator framework, it would be split up into two different files that you have defined for the key locator framework. And you can concatenate the content of those strings inside those two files to come up with the one entire ASCII encrypted string. Also, similar errors can occur when the data is not encrypted when it is expected to already be encrypted. Now, move on to slide number 21, please. When such error is occurring, it is reported inside the migrate encrypted info error.log. For example, if we have a problem with decrypting a user's password, it will say error while decrypting password for user, and then it will give you the user ID. Or if you are trying to decrypt some information from the order payment information, it will give you a similar error. It will give you the string that it's trying to decrypt. And with this information, we can identify the rows from a database table. For the first one, we're looking at the user. We can look at the user logon password to make sure that we can see the password is encrypted. And for the second one, we can see to make sure that all the data inside the OrgPay info table for the ASCII encrypted value is present. And move on to slide number 22, please. Now, if it turns out that the password or the encrypted data information is not what we expect, or if it's unencrypted, it can be encrypted with using the WCS encrypt utilities, such as the command invocation that I have put on this slide, where it says wcs_encrypt.sh, and then you put the value that you want encrypted, and then the merging key, the current merging key. If it's in the case of a user password that needs to be re-encrypted, I've included a link to the Info Center documentation that explains the process, resetting or encrypting the user password. Basically, you use the WCS password utility. You supply it with the password you want to encrypt, the salt, and then the merging key, and it will provide you with the ASCII encrypted value that you can put into the logon password field. I just want to remind you that just only a brief overview of the migrate encrypted info issues that we commonly see in relation to this encryption-decryption difficulty. And I highly recommend the WSTE on April 17th, for PCI compliance and security, and it will do a much further deeper dive into common troubleshooting scenarios as well. So slide number 23, please. Another migrate encrypted info issue scenario would be showing an error connecting to the database. In this case, we see that it's not able to connect because either the user or the password is invalid. This is commonly caused by incorrect database credential view, and the database credential that it's looking for reside inside the instance XML file. The most common scenario where this happens is when people tend to update the wc-server.xml and deploy that to the application server but completely forget about the instance XML when they try to rotate the database user password. And when that happens, it tends to screw up things when you're trying to run other tools that do not run inside the application server. So to recover from that, you would need to run the WCS encrypt utility to encrypt the database user's password against the current merchant key. And then you can take that ASCII encrypted value and copy it into the DB user password entry inside the instance XML file. And moving forward, it would be recommended to use the configuration manager to update the user, the database user password, and to also help you automate the deployment to the application server to update the wc-server.xml file as well. Next slide number 24, please. On this slide, we'll be talking about the mobile store, so I will turn it back over to Jim.
Thanks, Eric. All right, so now we'll take a look at the mobile stores and how some of the redirection happens. So a lot of times this will happen. User is not presented with the mobile store when on a device. This can, you know, they could be on an iPad, it could be on an iPhone, Android tablet, whatever, any kind of device that's not your standard, you know, browser from, you know, a regular desktop or laptop. Now, one of the things to be aware of is that you can also emulate these other kind of browsers from the desktop with something called a user agent switcher, and that can be very useful in helping to test the problems that are happening. So, what you want to do is you want to look at your wcdevices.xml, your struts config files, and as well as look at the commerce server and the struts tracing. This will help you determine what view based upon what device is going to be chosen. And this will help you, you know, you're going to take all these devices and items together to figure out what it's doing and what it's looking for and what you'll have mapped. So in this case, we're just looking for the login request. So first we'll look for the request URI equals whatever view we're trying to get. So a few things you can look for whenever you're looking at those, once you found that, is look at what the user agent that's being sent. And then in that same thread, we can see what device it's chosen. So we see here context device equals -31. If you see a -1, that's the default, and that means it's not choosing any one, but the default is just going to treat it as a regular browser. So what we would want to do is take that, you know, you're going to find your, whatever your request came in, look at the user agent, and then look and see what context device it shows. Slide 25. So one of the cases that can happen is the user was coming in and bypassing the store view, and it was going directly to bypassing redirection. So one of the things you want to do is that the user goes to the store's URL and they're not bypassing the redirection detection. Another thing that can happen is that the regular expression that's in the device, WC device.xml, does not match with what's in the actual user agent string. This became very noticeable here recently with the change of the BlackBerry browsers. The original BlackBerry browsers had a problem where, or not a problem, but their user agent string started with BlackBerry and then went on from there. The more recent BlackBerry devices now have the BlackBerry in the middle, so if you're trying to target the newer, like the Storm 2 and stuff like that, you got to check your user agent and your regular expression that is in your WCDevices.xml. Slide 26, please. So here's a case where user is presented the incorrect view. So we'll collect the same devices before, and so we're going to look at the user agent string. So we see here that it's an iPad, and it's coming from the Mac OS and all that good stuff that is going on with the iPad. So then we're going to review again. We're going to look for the find forward config, and we're going to look to see what device here is choosing -1 because it didn't find anything that matched. So is this the device ID you expect? And most likely not if you actually want to have something for the iPad. Or it could be. It could be going to the, you could not have a definition for the iPad. That's what you expect. Slide 27. So here the device mappings in WCDevices.xml is incorrect. So you just need to update your WCDevices.xml to ensure and ensure reloading of the file is enabled if needed. If you look in the Info Center, there is some information on how to enable reloading of WCDevices.xml. I can actually put a timeout value so that it will check every so often for updates to it so it can make it easier to update these mappings on a development or a production environment if you want that. Some of the things that could happen is if you look at the user agent string, iPads, like I said, we talked about BlackBerry, is in the middle, so you need to have your regular expression correctly identified. I have a blog post about how to use a regular expression finder to create correct regular expressions for Java to input into your device.xml to make sure that you're targeting the right device you want to. And I can have this put, have just put that up as well so you can take a look at that. Slide 28. I'll turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Eric and Jim, for a great presentation today. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for questions.
We have no questions over the phone.
And we have no questions in the group chat. So at this point in time, we will conclude the presentation.